Anybody that's a great persuader, you're one step away manipulating. And what's the difference? Persuasion is I win, you win, he wins. Manipulation is I win, you don't, he doesn't. The market has zero sorrow for you. Your mom has sorrow for you. That's her job.
What is up, you sexy bastards? It is your boy, Playa del Carmen, a.k.a. Rabbi Can't Lose, a.k.a. Noah Kagan. In today's episode, we're speaking with Patrick Bet David. He sold a very large insurance business that he ran uniquely and now runs a popular YouTube channel. But life wasn't easy for Patrick. He is a former refugee from Iran. He lived in camps in Germany, moved to America, joined the army, and has done a ton of different jobs to eventually get to where he is today. Very impressive, working his ass off story. Now, in this episode, if you've ever dreamed of rising from literally nothing to a very unbelievable success story, this is for you. In this conversation, you're going to learn three gigantic things: how unconditional love and pain has shaped him, how to identify your enemy and how that can help you, and how he won in this very competitive field and interesting field of insurance sales. You're going to enjoy those three things plus a bunch more ear nuggets along the way. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to hear another American dream success story, go check out Andrew V. Turb. He founded Qualcomm, yes, the $100 billion business. That's episode 296 in the feed. Also, we just launched 5taco.com. It is the easiest way to find software tools for people like you. Productivity tools, marketing tools, AI tech, everything. It's totally free. So if you're looking for your next tool, and you're like, dang, I need a tool that does this, go to 5taco.com, find what you need for free. Also, special pre-show shout out to listener BasketMan70. This is the business podcast that I needed. I've been contemplating and looking for a business podcast to get inspiration and ideas. And Noah Kagan's podcast hit the spot. Haven't heard anything this good in a while. Damn, BasketMan70. I love you and I love every other one of you gorgeous listeners. Thank you for your feedback. And if you want a shout out in a future episode, go leave an iTunes or Spotify review right now. We check every single one of them.
For the people that don't know you, can you share, like, in 30 seconds your story?
Yeah, born and raised in Iran, lived there 10 years. We escaped. 6 weeks after Khomeini died, went to Germany, lived at a refugee camp there for 2 years, 18 months. Came to the States November 28, 1990. Went to the Army, was in the Army for 2.5 years, 101st Airborne Air Assault, got out. Then I met a girl in the Venice Beach. She and I started dating. She was working on Morgan Stanley Dean Witter. I'm like, you always got nice cars you drive when you pick me up. She was one with money. I was broke at the time. I start with Morgan Stanley Dean with it. Then I left Morgan. I went to Transamerica World Financial. I'm there for 7.5 years. And then after that, October of 2009, I started my own insurance company. And we grew it from 66 agents. We've licensed 50,000 agents. I sold the company a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago. And then accidentally started a YouTube channel called Valuetainment. Turned into a podcast, turned into a consulting firm, turned into a product development business. And now we do a bunch of different things.
And now we're in your private cigar lounge
area. We're in a private cigar lounge. We turn the other side into a comedy club and a set, and we turn this into a private cigar lounge, two bars, and yeah, we're having a lot of fun with this building.
Can you paint a little picture of your childhood? I know you're in a refugee camp. What was happening with your family in Iran that made you guys leave for the refugee camp?
So a lot of chaos. Like right now, you see all the stuff you're seeing with Iran and Israel, and you see those videos of the rockets going or the missiles going. That was me in Iran during the war. When 500,000 people died in Iran, I'm living in the capital, Tehran. The war is going on between Iran, Saddam Hussein, Khomeini. I'm a revolution baby. A lot of chaos. I never played outside. My dad never let me play outside in the streets, ever. And my dad never wanted us to be outside. It's terrible. One time we got bombed 165 times in a day. Turmoil. We left Iran when we were getting bombed. And I'm just looking at my dad thinking, are we dying today or not? He was calm. Mom's crying. Sister's crying. I'm crying. But he's calm. I'm like, if you're calm, maybe I should be calm because everything's going to be all right. And you would hear these whistling sounds. Till today, seeing what these kids are going through, you would hear them. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Boom. Building's shaking. And then you knew by the bombs if they were getting closer to your house or if they're moving distance from your house. You're like, oh, that guy crossed our house, so we didn't get hit. Then you would come out and you would see the building where they hit the neighbor. Boy, they hit the street. And then finally, we got in a car. We went to another city called Karaj, which was like 2.5 hours away from where we lived. Then Saddam started bombing Karaj. Then we went to Bandar Pahlavi, Rash. Then they started bombing there. Eventually, my mom said, listen, we got to take your son out of Iran because he's 10 years old. The moment he's 12, he can't leave because he's going to have to serve the Iranian military. My dad said, good idea. We left everything behind, went to Germany. a lot of people that would leave Iran to come to U.S., they would either go to Spain, they would go to Germany, or they would go to Australia. We got our green cards in Germany, finally got our green cards. We lived there for a year and a half, and then we came here. We never had plans of living in Germany, even though we had family in Germany. Germany was like the pit stop to U.S.
And you went to a refugee camp.
Yes.
In Germany. What's a refugee camp like?
You're around other people that are trying to escape communism, dictatorship, folks who are judged based on what their faith is. So I'm with people from Yugoslavia, Miodrag, Anna Maria. I'm with Czechoslovakia, Jan Stav, Katarina Stav. I'm with Albanians. I'm with Afghanis. I'm with a bunch of guys that are trying to come to America. They're escaping communism. And we all have that in common. It's a dream to one day leave their homeland that they love to come somewhere that they can be free of their religion, of the amount of money they want to make, of the strong opinions they may want to have, of the fact that they can sit there and assemble and give their thoughts, their ideas, fight, compete, do all that stuff. That's what we're escaping from. And so it was a lot of average, regular people. Nobody had anything. And eventually I became a celebrity in the community because me and this girl named Katarina and her brother, I started a business. My first business at an airline in Germany, I would go collect cans, beer bottles. And I knew I wanted to buy the new Super Mario Brothers, and we collected 5,000 beer bottles. Each beer bottle, the owner would give me 5 pfennig. I got 249 marks. I went and bought the Super Mario Brothers, brought it back to the refugee camp. Everybody would come to, can I believe Patrick's got this? We'd go hang out. All the kids would be playing Super Mario Brothers. That was the first time I got a flavor of, you can get anything you want if you can help others find a solution for them. You can exchange money for a solution you may have for them.
How was it for your family when you got to the U.S.?
Dream. Went to Germany, came out here, and then I served in the U.S. Army here. Went from in Iran where everybody was like on TV every day, we hate America, too. I'm serving the enemy's military, and I fall in love with America. This becomes my dream to be where we are today. First, we landed in New York, the airport. I'm looking for Rocky. I'm looking for Goonies. That's what I'm looking for. And then you come to L.A., I'm living in Granada Hills, and eventually we end up selling in Glendale, and you're thinking you're going to see all these celebrity Hollywood, everybody all the time in the streets. You see nobody. And you're like, okay, we're finally here. Let's make it work. And then you'd watch TV and you watch the news and you see how open they are. There's a business model to trashing presidents and everybody's, oh my God, you can talk like this here? Yeah, it's actually a business model to do media, free press. We're not used to free press in Iran. If you get free press, you're going to get killed. There is no free press. So all these unique little things that you're trying to adjust to, the learning curve, the innocence, it's a beautiful thing that you're going through it because it, one, makes you realize, wow, this actually exists. What can I do with this? How big can I scale this? What are my real dreams? Can I really build a life like that? So I was the kid that was a dreamer, but skeptical it's not going to happen to me. So I needed my belief system to come up. I need somebody to believe in me, but I was a dreamer always. One day, what if one day, what if one day? I would tell stories about what if one day we can do X, Y, Z, or would you rather be the richest man in the world, the president, Michael Jordan or Michael Jackson? That was a question, and we would debate it. Oh, I would be Michael Jordan. No, I would be the richest man. No, I would be Michael Jackson. I'd be a president. I was always dreaming, always in that mode.
How do you think all that turmoil impacted you long-term or helped you as an entrepreneur in Iran? You have to change to Germany. They have to come to America and start all over.
Yesterday, I was having a conversation with one of my guys on my house at 7:45 because anytime you're trying to do something big with your life, you have to know if you're mentally and emotionally tough. Because when I hire somebody to play a very important role, important job, not a regular position that doesn't carry a lot of pressure, a job that's going to have a lot of pressure, I have to look at signs of you that you can handle pressure. If you can't handle pressure, and I know what I'm going to be doing long term, I know what I'm going to be going, I need the people who are those direct generals or leaders or influencers to be able to handle it. So, for example, there's a big difference between you being sick and you being tired. You can come and it's like, oh man, we had a long day last night. We were up till midnight, 1 o'clock. Dude, can I take the day off? Why? Because you're tired? Because you're sick. No, I'm sick. Are you sure you're sick? I am sick. Okay, cool. Let me see what you got. I am sick. No problem. See, those are all mental toughness things. So for me, in a military, there is no such thing as that. So today, it's obviously a lot softer because drill sergeants are worried about how to manage soldiers. But I was raised by a father that was not a guy that felt bad for you. He was a hardcore love guy. He set a high standard of, if you say you're going to do something, you better do it. never be afraid of the truth. This is the guy that's like that, right? And my mother would tell me, always fear God. You may lie to me. You may get away with it and nobody will know, but God's going to know. That fear of God, mom put in me, really worked very effectively as a young kid. Some parents don't like that style. I actually don't mind it because it got me to know at the end of the day when mom and dad are not around and I'm about to hang out with these guys that are going to snort coke and I'm going to go hang out with these guys that are going to go rob somebody. Hey, man, God's watching. I'm going to keep my act straight and not do anything dumb for myself. So I think all of these experiences in life created such high levels of panic and anxiety and fear and worry. And trust me, I don't recommend it for kids. But at the same time, I'll tell you a crazy story yesterday. So this guy I'm talking about, the football coach, right? He played in Portugal professionally and he comes from Brazil and he's telling me his whole story on what's going on. He says, the reason why Brazil produced the best players in the world is because they all played on shitty field. And so when you play on shitty field, you have to be more reactive to a bad bounce off a rock or a pebble and your feet are tougher. So you're not worried about this stuff. So ball is not perfect coming to you. He says, when you play on a perfect field, you're expecting every pass to be perfect without any bounces. You're expecting everything to be so smooth coming to you. He said, that's why Brazil is not what the Brazil used to be 25, 30 years ago. The day before, Dylan had a game and the field was the worst field we've ever played on. Every parent is bitching about it. And we're like, look at this field. Why can't we play on a better field? And he says, no, that's when these kids get better. Because again, sometimes in life, we want everything to be easy. You need a little bit of the chaos and madness and craziness because that either toughens you up or guess what? You realize you're not meant to do something really big and with a lot of pressure to it. When you gain fame and money and compliments, right? Everybody takes compliments in a different way. A man who knows how to manipulate and he knows how to use flattery to manipulate you, it means you show signs of weakness because you're dying for any kind of compliment. There's a difference between a compliment and flattery. Compliment is backed up with valid reasons why I'm complimenting you. Flattery is just making you feel good because I want something from you, right? Maxwell says something very powerful. He said, when you learn how to persuade, be very careful because you're one step away from manipulating. Be very careful because anybody that's a great persuader, you're one step away manipulating. And what's the difference? Persuasion is I win, you win, he wins. Manipulation is I win, you don't, he doesn't. So you experience people that take advantage of you at a young age. You experience people that take advantage of your parents and it creates this rage that I can't believe they just did that to my mom, to my dad. And then it stays here. And you either use that as a fuel to do something with it or you don't. I eventually ended up using it. You have to know that either choose a lighter job that doesn't provide a lot of pressure, or if you want this job, you have to choose to be mentally and emotionally tough more than the other guy. You can't say, I want a job with a lot of excitement and things that's going to happen with it, but I also want to have an easy. You know, I don't want the pressure to come with it. Life doesn't work that way. If you want the big accolades, glory, experiences, relationship, breaking bread with the craziest people that nobody will ever know, you're like, I can't believe I was just at this meeting that we'll never publicly talk about. It's going to be a private conversation, and you're in that meeting, and you're elevating in your credibility score with others, or people are starting to look at you as somebody that's an influencer, and behind closed doors, you're a little pansy. Nah, man, the market's not going to keep you like that for too long. The market has zero sorrow for you. Your mom has sorrow for you. That's her job, right? Now, one thing I learned, crazy way studying guys that keep going, that can't stop. They're not necessarily the happiest people in the world, by the way, okay? They're not, but they have something very unique. It's a very basic formula. When they were a kid, they experienced unconditional love. It's somebody that if you go to jail, if you do anything stupid, you get caught smoking weed, no matter what you do, that person will always love you. That's typically your mom. Very important to have somebody like that in your life. But the second person is missing for most people. Second person is a person you love and admire so much, but no matter what you ever do, you will never win them over. It's somebody that it's never enough. But I just did this. Never enough. Like the movie Judge, where you see Robert Downey Jr. going with his dad, Robert Duvall. And that scene is a beautiful scene, right? And the last one is the right enemy. You choose the right enemy that gets the best emotion out of you. Oh my God, good luck slowing this person down. Good luck. So it's not even about money. It's not even about houses or cars or accolades. It's about those three combinations.
Did you guys feel poor? How was it for you guys when you were in America?
Very poor. I was a lunch ticket kid. I sold my lunch. You know what my nickname was in high school? Simoleon. And I know it's funny saying it right now.
No, laughing at
it. You can't even say it nowadays.
Yeah.
But that's what they call me. I was that skinny. And the reason why I was that skinny is because I sold my lunch ticket for $2 a day, and I would never use it. And I would go take a bite from somebody, grilled cheese, and I would come, and I would go work at my place at Häagen-Dazs. That was my job, where I would sell hats in school. I was the one that would get welfare. And my dad was a cashier at 99 cents store. We were welfare babies. We had nothing going on, but we're just happy to be in America.
What was high school like for you?
I loved it. Never missed a day in school. Never. I had a 1.8 GPA, but I never missed a day in school.
1.8?
I had a 1.8 GPA in school. I loved math. I loved pre-calculus. I loved math analysis, and I could care less about anything else. All I loved was numbers and math and people. I've always been a fan of people and numbers. I'm curious about people and numbers.
So I'm curious, you liked selling things, you had big dreams, but I'm surprised you went to the military at that point.
I was escaping. Military for me was an escape. I was trying to get the hell out of Glendale because a lot of bad things were going on at the time. So for me, it was to just get away from everybody. Best decision I made, joining the Army. I wouldn't be where I'm at right now if I don't join the Army.
What was the experience like?
It was great because I was forced to make friends with people from all walks of life who have never met a Middle Eastern before. They're not from California. Many of these guys are from North Dakota, Mississippi, Tennessee. We're driving through Alabama. Guy looks at me, waitress looks at me and says, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Iran." I've never seen a nose like that in my life before. "You're literally from Iran?" "I'm literally from Iran." "No way, what are you doing here?" I said, "I'm in the U.S. Army." "What are you doing in the U.S. Army?" I said, "I'm a spy. I'm taking all your stuff back to Iran." I would just mess with everybody. And then, you know what the Army did? It got me to learn how to talk to different people from different walks of life, different backgrounds. I learned about Chicago culture. I learned about Mississippi culture. I learned about accent in Texas, Fort Hood. I learned about the culture in New York, Boston, how they would talk. My sergeant was from Boston. I learned about all of that. Then I learned about different gangs. A lot of gangsters joined the Army. They're trying to get away from trouble, right? So you're making better decisions in life. And it was a beautiful thing. Army, you learn about camaraderie, working together as a team. Most of the guys I was in the Army with, I'm still in contact with till today. So a lot of great experiences.
I'm wondering for people who aren't immigrants necessarily or didn't join the military, but they want to learn some of these different lessons, like what would you recommend them to do?
I can tell you, like, go work for a high standard sales leader who's going to kick your ass and not take shit from you. It's the closest thing I can tell you. Go in a startup environment with a guy that's being ran by an operator, that's a maniacal guy, that's hypomanic, that's not going to slow down, and see what it is like to survive in a startup environment for the first 3-5 years. And after 5 years, if you can make it there, dude, good for you. Respect. Most of the guys, everybody wants to be part of a startup working with Elon Musk. "Oh, really? Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. You know what do you think it's like working with an Elon Musk?" The guy buys Twitter, he turns it into X. Day one, 7,500 employees. Day two, he fires 3,750. Day three, 1,250 people quit. Day four, he's left with 2,250. And everybody's trashing him every day. And you want to work with that guy who's bringing the kitchen sink and he's staying at the office working 24/7? Yeah, but I bet it's such a great experience. I bet playing with Michael Jordan was such a dream. Go watch The Last Dance of what it was like working with a Michael Jordan. But if you're lucky enough, if you're lucky enough to work in that kind of an environment for 5 to 10 years, you're a human specimen. What you're going to be able to do and what you're going to be able to take from people, you're bulletproof. It's a lot of value for that. Now, if you stay there for 5 to 10 years, guess what that company is going to do to you? They know how valuable you are because of what you've done. And imagine the opportunity that comes to a person like you. But regardless, your market value increases if you can be in a place like this. So if you don't want to do military, go in an environment where it's high octane, high intense, nonstop, see how you react.
How many businesses have you started?
The swimming pool recycling business was my first one. That's when I learned how to make money. Then I had a recycling business of going to the local trash bins in Glendale with a shopping cart, collecting cans and 2-liter bottles and going to Albertsons to recycle in the middle of the night. I would go to my dad's 99 cent store. I would buy hats of LA Clippers, San Diego, San Jose Sharks, all the teams that would never win. And I would buy the hats for 99 cents and sell it in school for $7. When 9/11 happened, my number one selling shirt I ever sold, and I would sell a shirt called United We Stand. And I would buy these shirts for $2 and sell them for $15. It was always trying to find a way to make money and be a capitalist. And then eventually you end up having your break, but sales was the way I was going to go.
You were swinging a lot. I think that's something I always try to get across to people. It's one, it takes longer than you think. And then two, it's just like, you have to keep trying. You have to keep trying until you get it. So when you left the military, what were those years like before PHP? What did you learn through them? You worked at a gym, then you worked at a Morgan Stanley.
Bally's was awesome. Bally's gym was phenomenal because we had the smallest club in America, I think. Smelliest club. We won the Triple Crown. Triple Crown is membership sales, personal training sales, and supplements. We killed everybody with a small club because we had such a united team. It was so sick how united we were. We destroyed bigger clubs. And so from there, they took me out and they put me in Hollywood, which was the biggest club in El Centro. And then from there, they sent me to Chatsworth. I got a promotion and we took it from 42% of the goal to 115% of the goal. And that's when my moment came. Later, quit my job, went in financial services with World Financial, and I busted my tail. I went to work, working 80-100 hours a week, literally 7 days a week. I worked 7 days a week for God knows how many years, 10, 15 years. And then all of a sudden, crazy things started happening. First time in my life, I made $18,495 in a month, May of 2004. I go and show my dad, I said, Dad, I just made $18,495. He says, how? I said, selling insurance. No. Show me your deposits. Here's the deposits. Get out of here. Yes. That was the last day my dad ever reached in his pocket to pay for anything that he ever went out with me. May 29th of 2004. Best feeling in the world. I was 25 years old. I said, you don't do that anymore. From here, it's on me. I do this. This is my job. No longer your job. Incredible feeling because he's such a noble man and a kind man that did so much for me. And it was a great feeling. I said, the world's going to know your last name. They're going to have to kill me, but they're going to know I'm going to dedicate my life, rest of my life. So the world knows what God did for me and what you've done for me with your last name. They're going to know your last name. I'm making a promise to you right now. Boom. That whole thing we talked about earlier, unconditional love, unconditional pain. I'm telling you, that combo, if a human being has that, one can't fabricate this. When it happens, you have to use that opportunity and can't let it go. You got to say, what am I going to do with this thing right here? What am I going to do with this enemy? What am I going to do with this person that I can never please? What am I going to do? Am I going to go be like, oh, it's not a big deal. I'm just going to go live my life and smoke weed? Not this guy. I feel God's given us certain talents and he wants us to use it in a certain way. And I feel it's an insult if I don't use it. I take that very seriously.
What kind of life insurance were you selling?
Term, perm, IUL, index, universal life, and annuities.
And then that's what started PHP.
Yes.
Can you pitch me like what would your pitch would be?
As an investor or as an agent? Because it's different. If you want an investor, I'll give you the investor one.
No, as a client to buy life insurance.
Oh, yeah. I've always been a three options on what products to buy. You got term and you got perm. Term, it expires. Perm is permanent. So yeah, we would sell term, perm, and annuities. And that's all we focused on. I eliminated our broker-dealer, so we didn't sell securities. We didn't do stocks, bonds, mutual funds. We got fully focused after reading the book Blue Ocean Strategy. In the book Blue Ocean Strategy, it's all about increase, decrease, eliminate, create. We knew what to eliminate. We saw the industry that was 59-year-old white male. After we sold the insurance company, our average agent was a 34-year-old Hispanic female. And the market's never seen this before. I said, wait a minute, how did you do this? That's how we created it. And we created a system, a culture, an environment. You know, the industry is to update the leader's bulletin once a week or twice a week. We would update our leader's bulletin 30,000 times a day. You know how you check your creative studios or you're looking at what's going on with your tweets? Our guys would always be on their phone and looking at, oh my God, okay, that guy wrote a policy. Well, this guy just did this. Or that guy just did this. Everything was on an app that we spent 3 years building. We spent $10 million on the software, Bamboo. It took the company's valuation from 5 times EBITDA to 15 plus times EBITDA. That was a big difference. And it was a beautiful thing when that started happening.
How did you get your first customer in PHP?
7.5 years, I was already with World Financial. So when I left, I was already known in the insurance industry. I'm not known on social, but I'm known in the insurance industry. So I left behind my 7,000 clients and we started with 66 agents. And we took those 66 agents when we resigned on September 23rd. Of 09, I started a company. 30 days later, we got sued by a $400 billion company, company I was a part of. 8 months later, we settled. Nothing happened. We took the company. and eventually went from one state to 49 states with a few hundred offices with 50,000 agents.
So what was your peak salary or money you were making when you had the job at World Finance?
Just shy of $500,000. I'm making probably $450,000, $430,000 a year.
And so you transitioned into that because you saw that there was more money from that, doing the financials versus working at the gyms. And when you quit back at the gym.
Yeah, I knew I was going to do sales and I wanted to be somewhere where I was appreciated. I wanted to be somewhere that I can bring direct impact, that knows how to manage my drive. Because I have a unique drive, but I need somebody to know how to use my drive. And if I have a drive, and let's just say I'm reporting to you, but you're already done and you want to kick it and hang out and just relax, you're going to lose me. And so I never wanted to start my own company, by the way, ever. I wanted to be the CEO of that company. Remember when the movie Jerry Maguire came up? Remember that email he wrote? I wrote that email to my insurance company. I wrote that email, 16 pages, 9 points I made on how to take the company to the next level. I sent it to the guys at the corporate. Nobody responded back. Then I sent it to their bosses at Aegon. Immediately, within 30 minutes, somebody responded back. Sent that email to everybody else that didn't respond back. Asked everybody the next week to come to Orange County to meet with me in a five-hour meeting. I pitched my 9 points on that 16 pages. They did one of it for 30 days. 30 days later, they said nothing else. That's it. 6 months later, I started my own company.
So you're making $500,000. Life is good. And then one day you're like, hey, they're not taking me seriously.
Yeah, I'm done. Because I went to Atlanta to meet with them and all their lawyers. And I told them, I said, I'm here because I want four things going to happen today. I'm either going to stay here and be the CEO of the company. Number two, I'm going to sell my business and walk away. I'm going to linger around and find something else to do. Or I'm going to leave and start my own company and be a direct competitor. But I'm going to make that decision at the end of this meeting. And they said, you'll never leave. I said, I'll never leave. He says, no. Everybody that comes to the room like this comes to us. They want money from us. And we always give them money and then they stay. You're not going anywhere. You have too good of a job. You're getting paid to take care of you. You're not going to go anywhere. So no problem. Unfortunately, I met with a guy. When I looked at him in his eyes, I said, what's your vision with this company? He was the number one guy in the company. He wouldn't look at me in my eyes. This guy was my boss. He would be rolled as somebody that would be an executive to me. And I said, you need to tell me the vision of the company. Because if you don't have a vision, I don't think you have a vision with the company. I think you're lost because you're so wealthy and you have money now. You just want to play golf and kick it and relax. I don't think you have one you want to tee it up. The guy, what I trusted, respected about the fact that 30 minutes later, he flat out told me, you're right. I don't know what I want to do with the company. I said, I can't be in a company that the guy that's supposed to be the guy that's going to take us to the next level is a little bit lost. I can't do that. 29 years old. I'm going to run for 40 years, 50 years. I can't run here. And he said, you'll never leave. So, okay, no problem.
Can you break down the business model of PHP?
It's a high volume recruiting model. So I took what I learned from Bally's. So Bally's to me was a very scripted environment. Everything was scripted. So you would take all the FAQs of Bally's. For example, the most common objection that you would get at Bally's, hey, Bally's has a contract, 36-month contract, okay? 24-hour fitness is month to month. So most people didn't know how to overcome that objection. So I created a basic script on how to overcome that objection. Everybody in Bally started using it. So I realized in every product you ever sell, you need an FAQ. So I created an FAQ for term, for perm, for annuity, for the opportunity, for investors, for everybody. Once you know the FAQs, you just have to know the FAQs. And that's it. 99% of the time it's the FAQs, right? Morgan Stanley taught me human nature. And that it's not about just the script. You have to also learn how to deal with people and where they're at. And then I worked at World Financial, taught me the concept of high volume recruiting. If I'm looking to build a business to sell, if I'm a personal producer and I make $3 million a year, no one's going to buy my business because they have to buy me. And I don't want to sell for the rest of my life. I saw a massive niche of nobody was targeting middle America, Hispanics, African Americans. We became 54% Hispanic. While America's only 24%, we became 24% African-American, while America's only 13%. And then we became 51% millennial, 34 years old, young. And the insurance industry, that's not the case. And I said, let's roll. High volume recruiting. And then we created the licensing, the bonuses, the tiers that we would pay bonuses on. Had guys spread across the country. Then we started recruiting this way. And then we eventually ended up being in all states.
How did you recruit all these people?
Started off with me talking to you, and you introduced me to him. Then I got a chance to meet his sister and his mom and his dad, and they introduced me to their siblings, and I met their best friend, and who'd you go to wedding with? Who was your groomsman, bridesmaid? It's literally how it happened. One contact led me to $30 million. One contact. $30 million of money I made off that one contact.
What was your first year sales of PHP? And then what were the last year?
$2 million.
So in 2009, $2 million. What did you end up in 2022?
A little over $100 million, $120 million. It's a good sized business, but insurance is very hard. What you're doing is not hard work. It's work. Well, you're smart. You're wise. I had to learn how to do that. Insurance is very hard.
That's why I was curious the pitch. I was just curious how you sell someone insurance. I have a wife and we're about to have a kid.
Yeah.
I know. I'm like, I think I might need insurance. So I'm curious. I feel like you have a solid pitch about why.
But in insurance for you, okay, you're worth money though. So you don't really need insurance except for taxes. So for a guy like you, you're only buying insurance so your kids and your wife doesn't have to pay the taxes when you die. You're not buying insurance to protect money. A guy like you goes to the insurance agent and gets as much insurance as you can because it's nothing to you. It's so cheap. Literally, you know how much money it is for you? Like right now, if you were to say, how much is a $10 million insurance policy? And you said you're 42, cost of $10 million insurance policy, how much do you think it is per month? 42 years old. You're probably going to be getting a $10 million policy for $1,000 a month. What's $12,000 a year to you? Nothing. If something happens to you, they have to pay taxes. That $10 million goes to taxes. You're not buying it because your wife needs your life insurance policy. It's a complete different model for you, but you're not doing it like the average person. You're not the average person. The average person is making 80 grand a year, homemaker, breadwinner. You need a $250,000 life insurance policy to a $500,000 life insurance policy. You're buying that because God forbid if something happens to you, what's your wife going to do taking care of the two kids? It's not for you. It's for the 90% of America that desperately needs it.
Can you give us a ballpark of how much you sold PHP for?
Oh, yeah. I'll shy of $300 million. By the time the whole thing is over with our earnout and everything that we're doing, it's going to end up being more than $300 million.
What was it like selling for hundreds of millions of dollars?
Incredible. We were at Monaco. When we found out the money is being wired to Goldman Sachs, my wife and I are having breakfast at this restaurant in Monaco. And the way we cried during that breakfast was priceless because we'd made money. I bought my house that I live in right now. I bought it way before I sold the company. We sold the company a year and a half ago. So we made $35 million. We've had money in the bank. We've had that kind of money. But we've never had multi-nine-figure type of money. That's when you're sitting there and saying, hey, family was really calling? Now they're really going to be calling. You're going to find out you had cousins you never knew about. But it was a moment where 6 months of me being on the road, her doing payroll a day after we had a baby, and she's sitting at the hospital while the baby's sitting there. She's doing payroll for everybody. You go through those days and we realize how much we sacrifice, how much we almost lost it all. And the fears, the anxieties, the insecurities a husband and wife sees each other in that nobody else knows, that bond you can't describe. So that was the most unique moment we had when we're sitting across from each other saying, hey, it's official. Great feeling.
How did you treat yourself? How did you enjoy the money?
It's funny saying this. I kept telling everybody, I'm like, babe, when we sell it, I'm going to get a 200-foot yacht, and we go to Monaco, and we're going to live on the yacht for 2 months. We're just going to relax and all this other stuff. Anyways, it happened. We came back to work. And, of course, we celebrated. We did a lot of different things for ourselves, for our families, investments, different opportunities, Yankees ownership, places we've gone with the kids. Our Christmas has become incredible, the stuff that we're doing when we're creating traditions with the family. But we already had a great life. I already was living in a $30 million home, driving $1 million Ferrari, had a bunch of nice clothes. We go to the nicest restaurants. We've been all over the world, 40-plus countries. It wasn't like dramatically was going to change. This was now about really asking yourself, you really think you're a big thinker? Let's see what you're going to do now because you don't have to work anymore. Let's see, Mr. PBD, if you're a big thinker. Oh, we're going to really learn about you now. And that was the best exercise for us. And it was interesting seeing how she was going to do it. So I'm like, babe, you don't have to come to the office anymore. No, I'm good. She was at the office today. Every day she's at the office, right next to me, her own office. She wants to come to the office. But listen, marriage is the hardest thing you'll ever do, especially when you have a lot of kids and you're running companies and you're traveling and you're in the thick of things. You're at a phase, you're having a kid when you've already made your money. We were making it and having kids, four of them. We had four kids in three states. We moved our office nearly 15 times. We moved our house 12 times. And every time we moved to another state, my wife was pregnant.
Can you tell me more about buying the Yankees?
Yeah, the stake in the Yankees. Yeah, I'm a big baseball card guy. I love baseball. I'm like, when I have a baseball card, I'm in a whole different place. I love baseball cards. And I always was a fan of Mickey Mantle's 1952 Topps rookie card. So I made an offer to buy the 52 Topps rookie card. I made an offer for $19 million to PSA 10. The guy turned me down. He knows who he is. And then I said, okay, I'm going to see what's going to happen. I got a call from a guy who knew I wanted to be a minority owner of a sports team because long term, I'd like to be a majority owner. I think I'd make a very good owner of a team. And he says, hey, I got some teams that there's some spots on. I said, give me the names. He gives it to me. I said, no, I'm not interested. He said, who are you interested in? I said, really, it's only three teams I'm interested in. He said, give me the names. Yankees, Lakers, Dodgers. That's really it. So maybe I would entertain Raiders, and he called me back for Raiders. I'm like, I'm good. But then he calls me back a year later, 6 months later. He says, the guy who was on the board of the Yankees is selling. What do you want to do? And they asked me to fly out to New York for them to interview me. We shook hands, great conversation. They took us to the owner's suite. Incredible Yankees history, giving us private tour and field, everything. And obviously now it's a great experience because we go to Hamptons, get in the helicopter, go to a Yankees game, watch the game, come back. It's a dream. It's one of those things that it's truly a dream.
What are the perks of being an owner of the Yankees?
Access. It's really access. I got to accept if you sell. But what else is it? It's access. Weirdest people call me. Hey, I'm owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, and I love your podcast. I asked Tony to introduce me to you. What's up? How'd you make your money? I made it from Batman, $2 million guy. It's access. You're getting into the next level of community. Dylan and I were driving home, and I told him about his coach. I said, this coach is interviewing you, not the other way around. He doesn't have to coach. He's got plenty of clients. I said, but he's interviewing you. He says, why do you think? I said, because in life, the better you get and the more you improve, the better coaches show up. You control the quality of your coaches. Simple. You control the quality of your advisors. The more you move up, the better you do. They somehow, some way show up. And then you pick up a strategy you never thought about before. Wow, that's how you made it. Crazy. That's what you did. Yes. Wow, I never thought about that. That's all that happens.
What was the best advice you ever received now that you're worth nine figures? Best ever advice.
Listen, to me, in life, it's a different story than it is to be in nine figures. Nine figures was truly reading Blue Ocean Strategy. I'm telling you, when I read Blue Ocean Strategy, it was powerful because it made me realize, because this one guy was saying, we're going to be a holistic model. We're going to sell everything under the sun. And Blue Ocean says that's the worst way to do it. Pick and choose your niche. Instead of being in a red ocean, choose a blue ocean. Stop trying to directly compete with everybody. Why would you compete like this? David didn't compete with Goliath like this. He would lose. David competed in a different way. You got to figure out a way to compete in your own way. Once I figured that part out, I said, game, we're good. My confidence went up. And I said, I can pull this off. I think I can pull this off. And then it was just going. And then I combined content creation. And I never once sold insurance to anybody from Valuetainment. Never once. But the moment Valuetainment became something, I was creating content on the side. And then accidentally we took off, and then all of a sudden we got a million subscribers. The people show up, Life of an Entrepreneur goes viral, interviews come up, podcast comes up, and that part's growing. Natural, organically, it was taking place. So that was probably one of the biggest things for me was the Blue Ocean Strategy.
Today, you have eight businesses. Can you break down these eight businesses and the revenue that they're at?
So insurance is the ninth one, okay? But let's set that aside because I got a couple more months left for earnout, and then my roles change slightly. I'm still a full-time CEO to that company, by the way, till today. And by the way, after selling the company, 22 to 23, our EBITDA grew by 78%. The company that bought us, our EBITDA grew by 78%. Okay, just so you know, meaning the buyers are very happy as well. So that's that. Then you got Bedeva Consulting. Bedeva Consulting will be a unicorn probably within 18 to 24 months. Bedeva Consulting is something most people don't know about. If you right now go Google Bedeva.com, you will go to BedevaConsulting.com, Bedeva Consulting, the company. 8 years ago, when I was doing content, we got like 100,000 subscribers or whatever it is, 2016, say we got 100,000 subs. 200,000 subs. Mario one day calls me, says, Pat, some guy's calling, says he wants to hire you as a consultant. He's asking me what your hourly rates are. I said, I don't do no consulting. He said, Pat, I don't know what to tell. I said, just make up a number and see what he tells you. Mario goes back. I'm like, I'm running an insurance company. I don't even know how to take a payment from you. Goes up to the guy, says, $5,000. He comes back, he says, Pat, he booked 3 hours. I said, you're kidding me. No, I said, what does he want to do with me? He's just got questions for you. Is he in the insurance industry? Not at all. What does he do? Transportation. You're kidding me. No. Now, I don't even know if I can help you. I'm like walking and saying, why the hell you paid me $15,000 to spend 3 hours with you? But let's see what happens here. We start the conversation. By the time it's done, I'm like, I'm going to change your life. I just made you a lot of money. We took that business from $8 million a year to $60 million a year. That guy's going to be a billion-dollar company within the next 3 to 5 years, where he's at right now. Okay? So then next guy comes in, and then he kept coming back. And the next guy comes in. I'm like, guys, I can't do that $5,000 anymore. So then I went to $15,000, then went to $40,000. Then they started booking me for speaking. We'll give you $100,000. I said, it's not worth a lot of money to me, $100,000. We'll pay $200,000. Now it's $250,000, half a million, and $1 million international. And people cut the check, and I only do four per year. I don't even want to do them because my entire life today is built around a 3 mile radius of where you're sitting at right now. So the David Consulting, we do engagements for 4,000 businesses worldwide from 60 countries. That's Bedeva Consulting. Then you have Manect, all integrated businesses. Guy, lawyer, 7-minute call, bills me for 30 minutes. I said, what do you charge by the minute? He says, no lawyer charges by the minute. I said, one day I'm going to launch a company called Manect. Do you have a minute to connect? Let's Manect. Now there's the app. Very simple. Manect is growing, doing its thing. I can choose to pay you to respond back in an audio. I can choose to get a respond back in video, or I can have a 15-minute call with you. The talent gets paid 80%, Manect keeps 20%. Beautiful. So that's the second one. Third is the PBD podcast that's turned into business. It's generating God knows how much money right now. AdSense, sponsorship, it's just driving traffic. So that's PBD podcast. Then you have the merch company that we have with the gear that we're selling. We want 1 million people this year. It's our special Future Looks Bright gear, a hat or shirt. We want everybody to be optimistic everywhere they go and confuse the hell out of everybody because everybody is, there's so much fear of porn being sold. We want that. Then we got the cigar business. We got the comedy club. And we got a couple other ancillary businesses, but it's 9 businesses. We also have Valuetainment Investment Group, where people, if they want to raise money, you'll come to us. Hey, I'd like to raise $10 million. No problem. If we come to you to be one of the co-investors, we're always in ourselves with our own money. So we have a pool of accredited investors that if they want to be part of the list, they send the email to Valuetainment Investment Group. You're to the list. Every time we have a new investment, we'll send the email. You're interested, or what are you in? I'll give $250,000. I'll give $100,000. Yeah. So these are things that people don't know about.
It's a lot. What would you say your net worth is with all this stuff, equity, everything?
I think I'm close to $500 million, but I think it could accelerate very quickly depending on a couple big moves. If one of these things spreads, that thing can go fairly quickly. But I would say right now it's at $500 million.
That's a lot.
Capitalism works, though. Capitalism works.
It does. And I love that about America. My wife's brother paints houses. And I'm like, that's not available for him to do everywhere. It's really about how much work and how much attitude he has. And I have a lot of admiration. I know you do, too, for people like that in this country.
It's great. America's the greatest country in the world.
I fully agree with that. I've seen some of your interviews about it. What do you say the ones that have been most significant business books or life books for you?
Okay. So if you've never read Trillion Dollar Coach, think about you die. And 3 founders of a trillion-dollar company show up to your funeral because you coached them. That's Trillion-Dollar Coach, Campbell. If you've never read that book, that's a must-read book. Laws of Success, life-changing. I put Your Next 5 Moves on that as well. I wrote Your Next 5 Moves. Psycho-Cybernetics, Hypomanic Edge, First Rate Madness, First 90 Days If It's HR, Elon Musk's book, The Law, Atlas Shrugged, depends on what direction you want to go. There's so many, there are leadership books. Donald T. Phillips, Lincoln All Leadership. It varies. There's a lot of them.
I was curious, any poor performing assets you've had or bad investment experiences? Because I think you shared a story before where you're like, you bought hockey cards and a year and a half later, you sold it for millions. But I was curious, as you have the opposite experience.
Many. Are you kidding me? Like, I bought a lot of baseball cards that did nothing. I was a guy that was a penny stock guy. I thought I was going to make it with penny stocks. You know how much money I lost with penny stocks? Wasted my time with. I bought a clothing brand that I wasted my money and time thinking I was going to get it to be the next Burberry or the next whatever. Now, finally, I'm like, specialize, specialize, specialize. The more I specialize, the more I want. The more I generalize, the more distracted I got and more brain headaches, unnecessary stress, specialize.
And I feel like your specialty is running businesses. Yeah. Like, how do I be a better operator? I was curious if there's a playbook. I know you have 2 books out.
Yeah.
If people want to be better operators and either come work for you or how do they go
learn? I don't think you need to come work for me. I think what you need to do is go to the Vault Conference. We hold a conference once a year. It's at Palm Beach Convention Center, and we'll have 10,000 people there at this event. People go to a lot of different events. They call it Ball Conference the best conference for entrepreneurs. Here's why. There is no pitch fest. Every speaker is paid. Nobody gets up and sells you anything. The only time you're going to be sold anything is by me at the end of the event, and it's for 30 minutes. That's it. Nothing else. The entire time, we go through a 200-page manual, fill in. We do 6 case studies together. It's intentional from early in the morning to late at night. It's processing issues constantly the entire time. And then you walk away with a plan of exactly what to do when you leave that place. You're going to know who you want to be when you leave the Vault Conference. Go to the Vault Conference, thevaultconference.com. If you come once, you come second time, and third time, and fourth time. Guys come typically by themselves, then they go with their wives, and they bring their 5 executives, and they bring 20, 30 people. Because they want all their guys to be thinking like a strategist, because everything is sequencing. So they want their executives to be thinking like a sequencing type of guy. So that's the Vault Conference. That's what I would encourage.
What do you think your dad would say today? What, is your dad alive?
Yeah, he just turned 82 5 days ago.
Awesome. And what does he say?
If you come to my house right now and you talk to my dad, would say, I used to tell Patrick all the time, it's getting late. It's getting late. It's getting late. Finally, he listened. And he'd probably say something like that.
You're coming home late? What did they say? You're coming home late.
No, when I was 17, 18 years old and I would sit around and I didn't have my act to get a pre-army, it's getting late. Get off your ass. Go do something. It's getting late. I'm like, listen, man, I'm joining the army. I'm getting the hell out of here. I'm going to get away from everybody. And then I came back and I was like the drill sergeant. I was telling everybody what to do. I'm like, okay, you got to learn some soft skills. And then learn soft skills and the drive was always there. But no, my dad, he would also say, once Patrick knew his vision, what he was going to do, nobody was going to stop him. And yeah, that's what he says nowadays. But yeah, we got a very unique relationship. My kids love him. My wife and him love each other. My nanny, Melva, they drive each other insane. Melva said to me like 6 weeks ago, he says, Daddy, I said, what's that? You know what Papa did today? I said, what did he do today? He said he watered the plants today. He said, it's a very good sign. And he's showing us all this stuff in the backyard. Look what I built here. Look at this. It's future. You're optimistic about the future. Looks bright. But yeah, it's a very unique guy.
What regrets do you have? Do you have regrets from working too much? Do you have regrets from not making more money?
Let me tell you about the regret thing. You just said working too much. My dad worked 6 days a week, and he would leave 5 o'clock in the morning, and he would come home at 9. So we never see him except for once a week. And I said, Dad, answer your question. When I was in Germany at a refugee camp, you didn't see me for a year and a half. When you were in Iran, I only saw you once a week. So if I lived there for 10 years, 52 times 10, you only saw me 520 days out of 3,650 days. Okay? And when I lived here, your mom got a divorce. I only saw you 2 days a month. So 2 days a month over 6 years, it's not a lot. 24 days, 144 days a year over a 6-year period. Then I joined the army. You don't see me for 2.5 years. How much regret do you have? Do you ever sit there and say, man, I didn't spend enough time with my son? Does that ever eat you up and bother you? I'm asking for myself. His answer, so powerful. He says, 0 regrets. I said, Dad, you can't say that. You mean to tell me you wouldn't have rather spent time with me than doing what you were doing, working 5 to 9 or whatever you were doing? He says, 0 regrets. I said, Dad, how could you say that? He says, my job as your father that God chose for me to do was to raise a leader. So for the rest of our lives, when you're a leader, we can become best friends. Are we not best friends today? I said, we are. He says, that's my job, kid. There you go, man. That's my dad. My dad's a G. He wanted to raise a leader and you got to give him props. So now I got to do the same thing because he's only going to be known as a great father if I raise good kids. Because a great father, you judge a great father based on his grandkids, not based on his kids. If you have great grandkids, that means you duplicated good leaders. And that takes 60 years to realize. It takes a while. You may not even ever see it, by the way.
I hope so.
Me too.
What are we going to see out of you in the next 20 years? I'm curious for Patrick and David.
You know, I'm going on a 40-year run. And in my mind, it's so clear what's going to happen. Obviously, I'm not Nostradamus where I know everything what's going to happen. But in my mind, I'm clear what's going to happen. Who's going to be there at the end? Is God all of a sudden going to be like, no, your time is done. You got to come up and spend time with me because you're getting, we're okay. Other people are going to do the job. No problem. But if God keeps me healthy, there's only one person that can fire me, and that's the man upstairs. If God keeps me healthy, I'm going 40 years. I don't like what they're doing to America. I don't like what they're doing to kids, confusing them. I don't like what they're doing to parents. I don't like how they're pinning us against each other. I'm not a fan of that. And some people are using their billions to divide, manipulate, and destroy America. And I think we need some people that are not afraid, who can communicate, and they're comfortable in bullying the bully. They can stand up to guys that are intimidating. And it's a shame if you don't use that fire that you have in your belly to do something about it. Because this country gave me an incredible life. A life every day I wake up, it's like a movie to me. This doesn't make any sense to me. And I'm going to sit there and do what? Just take from what America gave? Whether you read the Kennedy family legacy or the Bush family legacy, you'll see one thing they have in common. Go make enough money to take care of your family, to take care of your kids, to take care of your wife, retire all of them, turn them into leaders, and eventually you have to figure out a way to give time back to public service. Public service you get to do through politics, church, or nonprofit. Pick and choose how you want to do it. This country is a too special of a country for us to not give back to. If we just come and take and we don't give back, it's a bit selfish. So 40 years, if we do what we do well, it's going to be a very good movie.
What things can you share if you're listening that you're excited
about? Media, movies, consulting, influence, politically, counsel. I'm not going to be involved in politics. I'm not born here, so I can't run for president. But in any other influential way, we're going to defend the values and principles that brought us to America, and we'll be one of the most powerful voices to do that the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
Any more immigrants here? I just love immigrants, man. Like, these immigrant people, like my father, your father, they come to these countries.
We need legal immigrants that come here and they fight for this thing. It was very hard for us to come here. I think what we're doing right now with the 10 million and just leaving a border open doesn't mean every one of them that's coming up here is bad, but all it takes is 600 of them to be criminals that are coming here and destroying America. We can't do that. We have to protect our country. This is very special. It's the last place that gives hope to so many other people in the world that don't live in America. So many people live in a regular country, and their hope is the fact that as long as America stays straight, they're going to watch what this idiot is doing, and hopefully eventually he's going to fall. But if that guy's not there, what the hell is going to happen with this? It's like in a family when they say you want to test someone's character, give them power, right? Sometimes you find out when you give certain people power, they don't know how to handle it. And that guy with power, the movie Gladiator, Joaquin Phoenix, he got power, never earned it, never went to war. He was a POS. He was a dirtbag, killed his dad, Marcus Aurelius, the greatest emperor we had. But he knew in front of his dad's eyes, no matter how he looked at him, his dad never looked at him as a leader. And that was a shame to him because he never went to war. He didn't know how to go to war. And then he faces Maximus and he realizes he doesn't have the eyes that guy has. He'll never have it. You can't buy it with all the money in the world. That guy was a bad ruler. Hurt a lot of people. What did Maximus do? Put him out. Cost him his life. Look at the pain he put him through with his wife and his kids. Now, I think for us, certain people are shaped in a way to fight for people that others need to save. As long as that guy's around, I feel better. So I don't think he's going to let BS happen. Every family has a person like that. Every community has a person like that. Every country has a person like that. Every great business had a person like that. You lose that person, bullies show up. Bullies exploit when those guys disappear. Those people, the tough guys behind closed doors, they've been hiding lately because they're afraid. Those guys need to come out and show strength because God gave them that courage to do something with it. Just think we need those guys to stand up and do what they're capable of, and everything's going to work itself out. But America has a lot of people around the world that we don't even pay attention to. America gets a black eye. Everybody wants to take a shot at America. But go in and get rid of America and see what happens to everybody else. Why is everybody become a capitalist? Whose model are they duplicating after? Oh, let me guess. America. Okay. Yeah, got it. So all the trash and shit that people want to talk about America, be lucky that we have a proven concept that worked and changed many people's lives, not just in America, but around the world. So we got some work to do.
Hell yeah.
That is a wrap. I hope you loved the episode as much as we did making it for you. Thank you, Patrick, as well. Go give him some love. He's got books out there on Amazon. You can check him out on YouTube, as well as his podcast, the Patrick Bet David Podcast. As well, have you gotten my new book yet? There's a few of you who have not, and I'm excited for you to read Million Dollar Weekend. If you've been wanting to start your business, or if you've been wanting just to build more confidence in your day-to-day life, go grab Million Dollar Weekend. It's been a fun ride for everyone who's read it. I look forward to hearing your feedback. Next, text a friend you love them. Yo, dog, let's go to the beach together. And before you go, tweet or slide in my DMs at Noah Kagan. I love hearing from you. And finally, a couple shout-outs to the amazing team who helped make all this happen. Jason at podcasttech.com for the show. Thank you to Jeremy, Cam, Sylvie, J. Diego, and Memo from the Dork Team for all the magic y'all do. Have a taquito day. What's your favorite ocean?